Hi, my name is Lloyd Sauerbutz, and this podcast is brought to you by Libreria, a bookshop by Second Home. In this episode, we welcome Colin McCann, the National Book Award winning author of Let the Great World Spin, and the Booker Prize nominated A Paragon, to discuss his first non-fiction book, American Mother, which tells the story of Diane Foley, mother of beheaded journalist James Foley, who has come face to face with her son's killer and continues to campaign for the safety of journalists and revised government hostage policy. American Mother is a formidable story of grace and moral courage. I hope you enjoy the conversation. Firstly, I just want to welcome you back to the Libreria podcast, Colin.
So happy to be back.
Yeah, it's been a few years.
Yeah. But,
you were last on here to talk about A Paragon,
right,
with my colleague Paddy. And I mean, that was a courageous book to undertake.
Thank you.
And you talked about the genesis of that,
right,
novel being something that you had to kind of try again and kind of incorporate the meetings and the transcripts of the interviews with those gentlemen that had lost children to mm-hmm. the conflict on both sides. But I wanted to ask you about those recent books like A Paragon and your new release American Mother, which is written with Diane Foley,
right,
the mother of the beheaded journalist James Foley. Yeah, I wanted to ask, how did you gravitate towards these stories? Because they are brave.
Yeah. You know, I sometimes wonder, what should you do as a writer? And is it my place to say what any writer should do? I can say what I feel that I should do. I'm not saying it for other writers, but I think I kind of want to engage. I want to be in the world. I want to write about what's going on. I want to sort of touch on those things that might get uncomfortable at times, but I'm not saying that that's what every artist should do. That would be ridiculous for me. But for me, it seems, and also you write towards your obsessions, and then sometimes you find the story comes along and you just can't get away from it. So with The Paragon, when I was writing that, I met Rami and Bassam in Jerusalem, and walking away from that room, I knew that I was changed. With this book, American Mother, there's a long, complicated history behind it. In fact, it goes prior to A Paragon. Everyone remembers seeing the photograph of James Foley in the desert in an orange jumpsuit with a guy beside him, the British jihadist, in a black balaclava and the knife in his hand, and what happened afterwards. I remember where I was and how I felt when I saw that photograph. But shortly after seeing that photograph, some friends of mine sent me another photograph, a different photograph of Jim Foley, and it was one of him in a bunker in Afghanistan, and he was sort of sitting down reading a book of mine called Let the Great World Spin. So the conjunction of these two photographs actually sort of messed with my head in extraordinary ways. And I ended up writing to Diane Foley, this is now almost 10 years ago, and saying, you know, if ever you want somebody to write about your son, or if ever you want to tell your own story, please, I would be happy to try and help you out. She never got the email, right?
Yeah, you say that in the beginning of the book, yeah, with the opening pages.
And
yeah,
it's it was incredible. Then 7 years later, I got to meet her, and then she asked me to help her to tell her story. And then I realized that she was going down to Virginia from her home in New Hampshire to meet her son's killer. And she asked me to go along with her. So we walked into that room together in a Virginia courthouse and sat down no further than you and I are right now, this very moment, yeah, you know, a couple of feet across the table, and talked to Alexander Cody, the man who had been involved in killing her son.
Yeah, because you detail how the meeting with Diane took place, and that was quite fortuitous because, yeah, you were doing an event with, was it Marquette University?
That's right.
Yeah,
right.
Which was Jim's alma mater.
That's right.
And then you were in contact, and how did you gain Diane's trust relatively quickly to be kind of invited to sit with her while she's meeting Alexander.
You know, the funny thing was, I didn't even know that I was going to write this book, but I knew that the story had to be told. And I knew that she wanted to tell it. So I went up to her house and drove up and met with her and her husband. And about a couple of hours into our conversation, John, her husband, said, "You remind me of Jim." And I took that as a great compliment. And then I ended up spending a couple of days with them. And over the course of that couple of days, I mean, the confidence in each other sort of deepened. And she introduced me to the whole idea of her story. I wasn't going to go there to write it, but then eventually I said, okay, I'm going to go with you, and let's see if we and it. You know, I actually was in the middle of another novel, which won't come out now till next year. Okay. A novel called Twist, and I abandoned that. I literally stopped it and said, "Okay, I have to jump feet first, head first, whatever else, into this particular book." And so we went down and we spent 3 days in total with Alexander Cody, and then I got the chance to sort of like get to know Diane and to try to tell her story. It's kind of a simple book in certain ways, in the sense that the structure was there, and Samuel Beckett said it's the job of the artist now to find a form that accommodates the mess. And the form of this book sort of hit me the minute I walked into that room. It was a big windowless room in a courthouse in Virginia, and Alexander Cody was sitting at the table. There were prosecutors there, there were defense attorneys, there were FBI, there were security guys. Cody was there in his prison uniform with the shackles on his feet. I walked with Diane, we sat down at the table, we looked at each other, and at that moment I knew, okay, this is the way that the book will open. And I sort of felt it and knew it.
Did you have a full conception from then, like how you were going to write it, or?
Not a full conception, but I just knew I was in the presence of a moment. You know the way sometimes you're in a moment and you actually like you almost hover outside of yourself, and you think you're looking down at yourself and you go, "I'm going to remember this."
Yeah,
you know, I know everything that's going on, and I'm going. So I felt that sort of way. You know, I didn't know that there was going to be a further moment. I didn't know that he was actually going to end up writing letters from prison to her, and all of those things that happened over the course of the year. So it took me a year to write this book. In general, it takes me 3-4 years to write a novel. This is my first nonfiction book, and it came together fairly quickly because all the material was there sort of in front of me, and I also had experienced it. But I tried to bring some of the techniques of a novel into the nonfiction, because I do believe that, you know, it's been a lot of my work actually in recent years have been sort of on the edge of fiction and nonfiction. What's true, what's not true, is also talking about, you know, the times that we're in, trying to get at the human truth, the textual truth, if you will.
Yeah, absolutely. I was going to say, a lot of your books do take these kind of seminal moments, whether they're kind of private moments or public moments.
Right.
And then you really kind of dive deep into the empathy and the emotion of the specific characters or real people. And it takes a novelist's craft and verve, and forgive me for being hyperbolic, but you are a master at it. Book one is incredibly heightened with the sensations. When you were in that room, you weren't able to take notes, were you?
No. They told me at first, you're not allowed to take notes. No tape recorders, no phones. Yeah. No note taking, but I had it like a sheet of paper in front of me, and I had a sort of book, and I was scribbling away. Now, I trained as a journalist back in Dublin many, many years ago, and I have what's called Greg shorthand, and every now and then I would just look like I was doing a doodle on the page, and I'd make a little note to myself when something significant was said, and then we would take certain breaks. So over the course of 3 days, we'd talk for a couple hours. Diane, myself, and Cody, and then we take a break, and I go scribble furiously some of my notes, and then go back into the room. And it was very interesting because he'd been described in the British and Irish press as a sort of a football hooligan, a soccer thug, and he was infamously a QPR supporter apparently. And one of my first questions, I was trying to figure out who he was. I said, You know, because I have a football background too. My father used to play for Charlton Athletic, and you know.
Oh wow!
I said, "So you're a QPR fan?" He said, "No, I'm not whatsoever." Like, and I said, "But all the newspapers have said that you are." I said, "Well, outside my uncle's house, there was a gnome that was in QPR colours, and somehow somebody took a photograph of that, and then they ascribed it to me." And then he began to talk about himself, and he became quite interesting. He was a fairly deep thinker. You know, he grew up with a Greek mother, a Ghanaian father. He lost his father to suicide at a young age. And he grew up in central London, and then got radicalized and then went first to Gaza and then came back and then went out to Syria. And, you know, things unfolded as they did, and they became notoriously known as the Beatles. But looking across the table at him, there was things that went on, and I was looking him in the eyes. He was looking me and Diane in the eyes, and we were asking each other sort of profound questions about compassion, about faith, about forgiveness, about violence, about war, about combatants and rules of engagement, all of these different things. And I won't say that I liked him.
Yeah.
But I will say that I understood him. He was actually reading a paperback copy of Patrick Radden Keefe's book, Say Nothing.
Wow.
And so he was interested in Irish politics. And so he was asking me a bit about Irish politics and things like that. And the other irony of all of that is that, you know, I'd been introduced as a family friend, not as a writer,
yeah.
To go in there. My name was on Patrick Radden Keefe's book because I'd blurbed it. And so sitting there on the desk between us was a book where my name was. And all of these little coincidences were coming together. But I have to tell you, honestly, Lloyd, it was like maybe one of the most extraordinary human moments that I have ever been part of, to watch a mother talk to her son's killer.
Yeah.
And tell stories about her son, and then also offer her forgiveness for everything that had occurred, but not in a like a pat way. She's tremendously emotionally intelligent, and she could feel things that were going on. And I tried to communicate that in the book. It was
you definitely succeeded. You've actually shared a lot more about your experience with Alexander than you do in the book, because he does sound like someone who's mildly irritated at his portrayal, but he does think deeply. But also, I felt a sense of naivety,
right.
Especially with the dependence on scripture for his rules of engagement. But
right.
You're writing about Diane.
Yeah.
I mean, she's a remarkable woman.
Yeah.
And you talk about this not being just a book about one mother, an American mother at that, but mothers everywhere.
Yeah.
And how deeply they feel and
right.
The tumult, and basically offer a portrait of Diane as someone who's incredibly dignified. I've written compassionate, incredibly empathetic, and always trying to be fair, despite the treatment of herself by the people we hope will help us.
Right.
And you write about what feels like initially how you imagine what she would be going through
right.
In the meeting, but I'm guessing that since you're in the room,
yeah,
you would have discussed her feelings after, like when you were able to take a pause. And over the subsequent years that you've been in conversation with Diane, what is your sense of her as a person, like what she's gone through and what she's taken from this?
My whole sense of her has deepened. You know, I liked her at the beginning, and I could recognize a sort of like that quiet fierceness. I mean, here she was. She's a nurse practitioner. She's a mother. She's a grandmother. She's all these things. But she's also that woman who, and she will say herself, you know, women of a certain age get looked past.
Yeah.
Now people and people say, "Oh, I'm sorry for your pain," and they don't really mean it. But she said, I want my son to be remembered. I also want to change the whole landscape of how politically, in the US in particular, we talk about hostages and hostage taking. So she's really tenacious as well, too. She goes in, she sits with Obama. Obama says, "Oh, your son was my highest priority." And she says, "Excuse me, sir, with all due respect, my son was never your highest priority." And, you know, she's prepared to put herself on the line, and yet she comes across as this woman of deep faith and family and all of this, you know, tremendous symphony of emotions. Like a lot of mothers, we tend to, like, you know, want to put them in a single container, but there's many different containers, and that was one of the things that I wanted to get across, the respect that I had for a person like that. And there's a lot of untold stories, in particular, I think, about women, and certainly older women who are doing things to change the world that don't necessarily get told. And this is one of them. She's an amazing person who continues to this day to advocate for hostages around the world, including whether they be in Russia, Venezuela, Mexico, or now in Gaza. So she's bringing the legacy of her son into the world so her son doesn't die.
You write about in the, I think it's in the immediate aftermath of the news of Jim's death, that they didn't want to seek revenge.
Right. Like
the internet was baying for it. I think you write that it was howling out for revenge. And the family were being sent gifts from far and wide and some donations, and she started thinking about Jim's legacy and what she wanted his legacy to be. And I've pulled some quotes. Jim knew that in order to know, we have to listen. Listening is the quiet soul of storytelling. And you feel that she kind of took on the listening quality, but also she was very critical of policy. Obama's administration doesn't come away from this with any good words. She talks about not so much herself, really. I mean, she does talk about being boxed in as a woman of a certain age, as being seen as the emotional and impulsive mother
who
at best is tolerated, if not ignored and made invisible. And she's sat in meetings with, was it the Global Post, who had a kidnap policy, like insurance meeting. And I guess that sowed the seeds for her to kind of actually lobby and change. And you write about the work she does.
Right. She's out there, you know, with an umbrella outside Congress, like walking in, like knocking on doors. And you know, for a long time, she wanted to tell the story, but she wasn't able to tell the story. But, you know, it's very difficult. As you know, it's like hard to sit down to write. People think, oh, just because you have a story, you have a book. And she wasn't able to tell the story, but she did the most incredible things in terms of just you know, knocking on doors, say, you know, getting new legislation put in place. Now the whole you know, the U.S. as in Britain used to not negotiate for hostages whatsoever. It was an absolute blanket policy, no negotiation whatsoever. That's all changed. Since Jim's death, over 100 Americans have been have come home, and the government has brought in all these different acts and hostage you know, awareness groups. They don't have any official policy about it, but you know, the French pay for their for their hostages, the Spanish pay for their hostages, the Italians do, the Danish, you know, but they didn't. And one of the great ironies of this is that, you know, she wanted to pay. She tried to bring together some money. She got over $1 million. They threatened her with prosecution if she paid for her son's ransom.
Yeah.
7 years later, Cody and El Sheikh get captured in Syria, stripped of their British citizenship, brought back to Washington D.C. and Virginia, put on trial. The trial costs anywhere from $50 to $70 million.
Yeah, and she writes about this. One of my essential questions has always been, why did we get the Z team, the essentially uncoordinated response when Jim was captured? And why did we get the A team, the very best of American justice, after he was killed? Why did we spend so much time and money in the aftermath of his death and very little on the extension of his life?
Exactly. And it was, you know, it was bizarre to see that that trial, which is just a short while ago, a couple of years ago, because they brought in experts from Syria. They brought in language experts from all over the country. They brought in hostages who'd been in Denmark, and they paid for four defense attorneys for El Shafi El Sheikh. All this stuff was what was going on, and at the back of her mind, it was always saying, "But why didn't we? You know, we do this earlier." But also, they didn't ship them off to Guantanamo. And they didn't ship them off to Abu Ghraib. It was for once American justice was sort of standing up and you know, saying, we're going to do this the right way. Guess what? British press went.
Yeah.
French press went. The American press
turned up on one day.
One day. Yeah. One day. The opening day, actually 2 days. Opening day and verdict day. But they were all packing the courtroom for Johnny Depp. And and that's an important case. I get it, you know. I know, but it was all about celebrity, and it said something about the American engagement, and but also this is a story about journalists and journalism, and right now, as you know, we're living in a world where journalists are being like decimated, in whether it be in Ukraine or in Gaza. And Jim was a frontline journalist, very much a frontline journalist. He was right there at the very, very edge. He wasn't protected by any big corporation or anything like that. He looked after himself, had to find his own minders. And he went to the edge because he knew that he wanted to bring the story back, the truth back in a certain way.
Yeah, you talk about journalism as this noble profession, which it is. But the bigger corporations, the CNNs, BBCs, as soon as there's the slightest hint of danger, they pull their journalists to a relative degree of safety.
Right.
So we perceive them as, you know, broadcasting from hotel balconies with stuff going on in the background and think, oh, wow, how brave are they? But because Jim was freelance, it didn't have that protection. But he also, you write about his moral courage, Diane talks about his moral courage.
Exactly.
As a journalist, he wanted to go sooner, go deeper and get closer, to paraphrase how he saw his profession.
Yeah.
How do you feel like the safety of a James Foley can be protected in the future?
Good question. I mean, the thing about it is I'm a journalist, right? So I started out in Dublin in the 1980s. I went straight into the newspapers when I was early 1970s, when I was 17 years old. I have great respect, come from a family of journalists, and I still believe I'm a journalist. Even through all my novels, I'm still practicing a form of journalism. And yet I see a world where it's being being slowly chipped away at, and we need people to stand up and to take account and to start telling these sort of stories, because if we're going to protect our democracy, if we're going to protect language, if we're going to protect stories, and in particular the supposedly anonymous corners of human experience, because you can talk about policy, you can talk about politics, but a journalist like Jim Foley was going in, he was going into Damascus, he was going down to the markets, he was talking to the old man who was playing chess in the corner, or talking to the young girl who has a backpack full of books, and trying to figure out, how war affects, these quote unquote ordinary people. And that's one of the things, in a world that increasingly, seems to be available because we have the internet and all that, sometimes we lose sight of the real power of the supposedly anonymous corner of human experience. And that's what Jim was after. And that's one of the reasons why he got kidnapped, because he was in a dangerous place. And some people say he was reckless. Some people say he should have known better. But he felt that he had to do it. You know, he's gone, but his legacy continues. And that's why what Diane does, what she does, and she continues. It's almost like Scheherazade-like, in the sense that, Scheherazade in 1001 Nights, she tells the story in order to keep herself alive.
Yeah.
Well, Diane tells Jim's story in order to keep him alive. And he was quite a, I think his story will be around for a long time. It's innately tragic, but there's something beautiful about it too.
Yeah. The event and the residual imagery is, I hate this word in this context, but it's iconic and it won't go anywhere.
Right.
And Diane's doing a lot of work for policy change in how nations address hostage negotiations. Is she doing work on the journalist side in order to protect them? Because, yes. Like how would that look in terms of, would it be an umbrella organisation?
Yeah, so through her foundation, the James Foley Foundation, they actually have gone into journalism schools in Northwestern, in Columbia University, in New York, and they do journalistic training, the safety training. They talk about like first aid, how to look after yourself, how to get insurance, you know, all of these different things for these young journalists who want to go to these places where other people might not go, and you know how to look after yourself, and we need those people. We need those people, because otherwise they'll all become silenced, and all these great crimes, and not great crimes, I mean these terrible crimes get committed, and nobody ends up talking about them. Look, you know, you think about all the journalists in Gaza who are being, you know, blown away right now. Almost 100 people trying to tell the truth and bring out, we know that the power comes from, you know, talking about the ordinary things on the ground. That's an important thing for any journalist and for all of us to read.
Yeah, because truth is the first casualty of war is something that's always parroted. But if a journalist can't get on the ground and get close up to the action safely, then the story's, the truth is open to manipulation.
That's right.
I'm very keen to talk more about the changes in the policy, because Diane is critical of the Obama administration, but it could have been any presidential administration that's held up for criticism because there's too many agencies involved. She writes, or you write, that Diane felt there was a lot of chaos, a lack of strategic alignment.
Yeah.
Do you know what is going on in terms of realignment of policy? Yeah. Is it just solely America now, or is it?
I believe that it has a knock-on effect here as well. I mean, when you start focusing in on things and you say, okay, we need to have hostage units, we need to have emissaries who are talking about hostages, we need to focus in, we need to know where all the logic goes. That's something that before it was just scattered all over the place. Nobody knew where the power lay. Nobody knew where there was any, if there was any sort of centrality or how to go about this. You know, the CIA didn't know, the FBI didn't know, the families didn't know. They were kept out in the cold. Now Diane, through her foundation, she talks with the family. So all those people who have, say, loved ones in Russia can go to the Foley Foundation and say, you know, what do I do here now? Yeah. And how do I get my loved one back? And how can I negotiate? And a lot of the time, you know, we think, well, you shouldn't negotiate with these people, you know. But even paying ransom at times is a way to get someone back. It's called lure money. You know, you pay the ransom, but you can follow the money. And then you can get it back, and there's all sorts of shades going on in the whole world of hostages and hostage taking. That's Diane is actually privy to. You know, there are hostages. There are many more hostages than gets publicly announced. But at any given time, you know, when you're talking about the Syrian border, the Iranian border, Venezuela, Russia, there are motorbikes going back and forth across borders. There's briefcases, there's cash. It all sounds like a John le Carré novel.
Yeah.
And in fact, it is in many ways. It's still like that. Bitcoin transactions, all this sort of thing.
Yeah, which are traceable. And you talk about Jim initially being captured and held hostage in Libya, and his successful release was actually through an intermediary, but almost like an intimate, a friend.
Yes.
So it's not always lure money, but sometimes it is just those close connections that maybe the bigger agencies don't have.
You know, here's the thing. You know, we need to what I learned from the novel I wrote, A Paragon, where I talked with Rami and Bassam, one Israeli, one Palestinian, and they very wisely said to me, look, we don't need to love each other. We don't even need to like each other. But unless we understand one another, we are absolutely doomed. And part of it is understanding. So when Jim got originally released in Libya, it was somebody who understood the culture. It was somebody who could go in and talk. It was somebody who could create a relationship. Rami and Bassam say, none of this will be over until we talk. And that's one of the things about who we are now and where we are now. There is a sort of refusal to talk. We end up sort of in these lanes of absolute certainty, you know. Come into the room if you look like me, or you vote like me, or you sound like me. But if you don't come into the room. And this is a problem with where we're operating now. We need to be, I mean, I'm deeply interested in writing an essay called In Praise of Messiness.
Yeah, yeah. Know? What would that look like?
But it would, like, embracing contradiction, having the ability to hold contradictory truths at the same time. You know, everybody says, you know, they want answers to questions. But my favorite answer now, increasingly, is I don't know. Yeah. It seems to be an honest way to answer, you know, a lot of questions. I just don't know. But let me try it, you know, and try to figure it out. But there are a lot of shades here. There are a lot of angles. It's kaleidoscopic, and so it's the job of the writer to get into the sort of like the glass of the kaleidoscope,
yeah,
and to have several shades for herself or himself, and then project that, allow the reader to go in, and the reader then makes up their own mind. Because, look, writers are not there to tell people how to think. That's the worst thing, when you just try to tell someone how to think. But if you allow somebody to go in then to think for themselves, or to outthink you as a writer, that's where the great privilege comes. Because often your reader is so much more intelligent than the writer, and they bring in their own life that extends the life of the book outwards, which is the metaphor that I liked for a paragon, which was, and a paragon is a shape with a countably infinite number of sides. And so any one story actually has a potential infinite number of sides if we're open to letting it expand.
You've touched on so many other things in the book, the idea of, like, the American national sensibility at the time, because we know, therefore we're not willing to learn.
Right.
This In Praise of Messiness idea is a case of actually staying humble and saying, I don't know. Therefore, I'm going to ask, and I might not like the answers, or I might not.
Right.
I think it's definitely the way to go.
Yes.
I know definitely, as I'm getting older,
yeah,
I am becoming increasingly unsure.
Like, that's even good. Yeah.
Like, in current events, I, up until like a few years ago, I thought I knew. And right. Then I read A Paragon.
Right.
And one, I did have to kind of look up what the definition of what a paragon was.
Me too.
Yeah. And I thought, okay, I understand what Colm's doing here. The beauty of reading A Paragon was that I saw the similar stories in the two transcripts with Rami and Bassam, but the way you wrote the book, this is not so cut and dry.
Right.
For
me, I I will tell you this, that when I went to write about Israel and Palestine, I was confused, and I had to acknowledge that confusion. And in fact, I go immediately to try and confuse the reader in the opening pages. There's sections about birds, there's sections about Francois Mitterrand, there's sections about missiles and all this different stuff. But one of the things that's interesting to me is, look, I grew up in Ireland. My mum's from Derry. I'm from Dublin. I knew a lot about, you know, Northern Ireland growing up, and experienced a lot. But I'm still confused about the North Island, and it took me a long time to be brave enough to say, "This still confuses the holy living hell out of me." And if it confuses me, who you know, having lived there, studied it, I can't imagine what it's like for others. So if we can acknowledge that confusion and say it's okay to be confused, especially if we can do it in schools, right? And if we can get young people to think in several different directions, and we might become better at all of this. And I do think that storytelling is a place where peaceful engagement might actually lie. So, in other words, you know, Diane has to get her story out into the world because it helps us be better. And she's not saying, you know, it's absolute. She goes in and she sits with her son's killer. Yeah. She says, "I want to understand you. I also want you to understand what you took from the world." This was my son. My son was Jim. He was, you know, he was a great writer. He was a, you know, and so that's messy, but it's also quite beautiful. And maybe messy is not the right term. Maybe mosaic is part of the term, or maybe we come up with a messache.
it's open to negotiation. Yeah, definitely. Because messy, it has its implications, but right. You're definitely right in and using writing as a way to address a fundamental concern
right.
that we're actually at as well. There's so much filtering of opinion.
Yeah,
people are really adamant, they're sure. And someone like Diane, who's got that wisdom that has come with circumstance, and she writes that she's trying to find a way to understand what is the motivation for killing her son,
right,
and show Ken Alexander that you killed someone who actually wasn't dissimilar to you.
That's right.
Yeah,
there's that moment where she says she looks across the table and she says, "Oh, you and Jim could have been friends." And she meant it.
Yeah.
She meant it. Like she looked at him and said, "You and he could have been friends." And he was shocked by that. He sort of rocked back on his toes for a minute, and then he sort of it was something that he had to take away with him and think about. But look, he's in prison now. He is in federal penitentiary in Florence, Colorado, 23 and a half hours a day in a single cell. And I think you can think what you want about punishment and so on. But I think it's wrong to do that to a human being, to be in sort of solitary confinement. But I only wonder what's going on in his head. And I hope someday to be able to meet him again and to figure out what happens. But one really hopes that he doesn't become further radicalized in his isolation. Mm-hmm. He has got a lot of time to think about his guilt, and he doesn't get to see his daughters anymore. Yeah. One of the moments that was most poignant with Diane was when Alexander Cody opened a file that he had in front of him, and he said, "I want you to see these." And he slipped across a couple of photographs of his beautiful young daughters, three girls in like pigtails and these gorgeous little dresses. It was very bizarre to think. And he said, "These girls are in a camp now in Syria." Turns out now they've moved to Turkey. But it all became intensely human. At that stage, he wasn't just a killer. He wasn't just an ISIS member. He wasn't just a beetle, as he'd been called in the press. He was a father, and he was intensely sad because he would never, ever, ever see his daughters again. And she felt that too. And she said, "Look, this is sad. Jim is gone from the world. You've lost your country. You've lost your freedom. The girls have lost their father. Your wife has lost their husband. We've all lost here." And let's start talking to one another so we can regain something, which is, and the only way we can regain things, I think, is through the power of stories and storytelling.
Yeah. And is that what you want the readers of American Mother to take away?
I kind of do. I mean, they can take away whatever they do. As I said, readers are always much more intelligent than what I have to say. I would love for them to come away with that and to make it further into the world, bring it into schools or whatever, or just think about people across town from you. You know, it's Rami and Bassam taught me that too. You've got to know your enemy, and it also becomes more difficult to inflict harm when you begin to know your enemy. You know, there are people in parts of Palestine now who know nothing about the Holocaust. There are people in Israel who know nothing about the Nakba, yeah. Yet if they did, things would be slightly different if we started to talk about them more.
Thank you for listening. I wish to thank Bloomsbury Publishing and Colin McCann for their time to discuss Diane's story and Colm's writing and ideas. Visit our website liberia.io for news of our future events and current book recommendations.